So we are going to be in Esther 3 tonight. And before we start Esther 3, the last thing we finished with in Esther 2 was Mordecai disrupting a coup attempt. And what I said last time, and I will say it again now, is that sets up the rest of the story and it sets up the whole situation. I did some more research, checked some dates and so forth. And first off, as you remember, the big feast was in the third year of Ahasuerus. Assuming that he is Xerxes I, which I do, he reigned from 485 to 465 BC. And the third year of his reign would have been 482 BC. And he doesn't get married until 4 years later. So the interval there between 482 and 478, what he was doing is he was on campaign in Greece. So I looked up the Persian-Greek wars, and his father, Darius, had campaigned into Greece. He was defeated at the Battle of Marathon. You know, where we get the race name for, the Battle of Marathon, the Greeks met the Persian army and defeated them. And there was a runner who ran back to, I believe, Athens and announced the victory. And the distance that he ran was 26 point whatever it is for a marathon. So the marathon race that gets run all the time today is theoretically a memorial of that event. But anyway, Darius the Great got repulsed, and that was in 490 BC. So he comes back, his son ascends the throne in 485, which is 5 years after Marathon. Xerxes I becomes king. He has this big feast in the third year of his reign. One of the things that the Bible commentary that comes with Logos that I have speculated was the reason he had all of his provincial governors and everybody in there for 6 months was they were planning the next invasion of Greece. Now, Yoram Hazony, the author of one of the books I'm using, said, no, this was just an ego trip on the part of a young king. And the commentary says, no, this was gathering all his resources together to go invade Greece. He ascends to the throne in 485. He has the big party in the third year, which is 482. He then personally leads the invasion of Greece in 480, 2 years later. He wins the Battle of Thermopylae. That's the Spartan 300 that they made the movie about. He wins that battle, and he goes all the way down and he burns Athens. The Greeks, however, lured him into a naval battle at Salmus. And at the Battle of Salmus, they destroyed the Persian fleet. So the Greeks defeated the Persians at the Battle of Salmus. And that was 480, same year. So after the Battle of Salmus, Xerxes went home and left the campaign, if you will, in the charge of one of his generals, who then finally lost it all at the Battle of Plataea. The reason I'm telling you all this is it occurred to me that the reason that the two guys wanted to dispose of him is maybe because he lost the war. So it was intended then to be a coup to get rid of this guy because he had lost the war and install a new government. That's a speculation. Scripture doesn't say that. And I don't have any extra biblical sources that say it either. But that's one of the things that happened. So, for example, when Sennacherib got repulsed at Jerusalem and went back to Nineveh, he was murdered by his own sons for being a loser. And the two sons that murdered him fled, and the third son then took over as king. So the idea of a king or an emperor getting defeated in a foreign war and then getting deposed immediately thereafter happens. So my speculation then is the reason Big Ben and Teresh might have been plotting a coup is because he had lost the Greek War, and that was sort of the high point of the Persian Empire, and things started pulling back after that. So that's for background. So now we get the introduction of Haman. Let's pick it up at chapter 3. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and seated him above all the officials who were with him. This is now speculation. Scripture doesn't say that. What I think is going on there is after the assassination attempt, he pulls in and basically goes into a bunker. You remember the great feast where he's got all of his officials and all of his provincial governors and everything there. And as I say, I'm asserting he was getting ready for the invasion of Greece. That was wide open. Hundreds of people, everybody drinking and having a great time, all of that kind of stuff. And after this assassination attempt, he pulls back into a bunker. And what he does is he appoints Haman, and Haman controls access to him. Now, several things about Haman. Thing one is Haman is not mentioned among the people who are mentioned at the great feast. This is the first mention of Haman, period. So before this, Haman was not high enough in rank to have been listed as one of the participants in the great feast. Nobody has any idea what he was before. He just sort of appears. And I am again speculating, but I suspect that what Ahasuerus said was, oh, shoot, my personal bodyguard just tried to assassinate me. I need to get somebody new in here from the outside that I can trust. I'm discovering I don't trust anybody else around me. So he gets Haman and puts him as his chief of staff, if you will. And he is also the gatekeeper for access to the king. And one of the things that we'll notice later on is when Mordecai tells Esther to go intercede with the king about the edict to kill all the Jews, she says, I haven't been in his presence in a month, and the law is if anybody comes into his presence uninvited and he doesn't extend the scepter to them, they get killed. So I am seeing this as extreme paranoia on the part of the king because his most trusted people tried to kill him. Now, the other thing that I will say, and I'll say it again when we get there, I don't think it was any risk to Esther whatsoever. The law was the law, but he has just deposed one queen. The last thing he wants to do is depose another queen. So when she goes in there unbidden, I don't think she's in any particular danger whatsoever. Just because I don't think he wants to go through the let's find another queen bit. The other thing about Haman, which plays a big part in the story, even though it's not stated, is he's an Agagite. You all remember when Saul was king of Israel, he was told to go wipe out the Amalekites. And he went down there and he wiped everything out, except he kept the best livestock to sacrifice to God. And he also kept King Agag alive. And then Samuel comes in and says, what do you got, cornflakes for brains? And kills Agag. Agag is an ancestor of Haman. Just as the Jews remember their history, the Agagites remember their history also. So when Mordecai announces himself as a Jew and refuses to bow down to Haman, Haman, instead of just taking Mordecai out, decides, I'm going to get them all because they wiped out my ancestors, turnabout's fair play. So that's all the politics and stuff, as far as I know, behind all of this. And when you look at it from that point of view, almost everything makes sense. The only thing that doesn't make sense is Mordecai's behavior. And we'll talk about that when we get there. That's our setup. So I'm all the way down to verse 2. And all the king's servants who were there at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told him that he was a Jew. So he doesn't bow down, and everybody's saying, "What? You're rebelling here. What's on your mind there, guy?" And he wouldn't say. He does identify himself as a Jew. You remember he specifically tells Esther not to identify herself as a Jew. So all of his best friends go and rat him out to Haman just to see what's going on. They're all at the gate. In fact, I was listening to Ron Dart today. He had a very good program. He's talking about the minor prophets right now. And he was talking about the gate of the city. And what he said, and I hadn't thought of it this way, but he's absolutely right, is the gate of the city is the plaza in front of the county courthouse. For example, when you foreclose on a piece of land, the foreclosure title has to be read from the steps of the county courthouse. That's the way it is done all over America. You post a notice on the front of the county courthouse, you read orders from the front of the county, and he says, the gates of the city were that kind of a place. That's where everybody gathered. That's where legal proclamations were made. That's where gossip was exchanged. And that's where you could get witnesses to a contract or any of those kinds of things. You remember when Boaz wanted to redeem Ruth, he goes to the gate of the city, gets the other near kinsmen there and a whole bunch of witnesses and says, "All right, you can buy the field or redeem the field from Naomi, but when you do that, you got to bury Ruth." And the guy said, I don't think so. It will mess up my own inheritance." And obviously you all know the reason for that is the firstborn son of the union between Ruth and whoever marries her then becomes the heir to that land. And what he said, it will mess up my own inheritance if I have a stray kid in there. Anyway, the point is Mordecai is sitting at the gate, which is where all the movers and shakers sit. It's like being in front of the county courthouse with everybody sitting around chewing tobacco and swapping yarns. So when all of these other people see Mordecai isn't bowing down to Haman, I said his closest friends, but those are also people who are political in nature and are striving. And what they want to do is find out, well, if he can get away with it, why couldn't I? You know, that kind of thing. So there are all sorts of political calculations. And as I say, in the process, they rat him out. And he never gives a reason other than he's a Jew. So verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. Now, sequence here. I don't know that Haman had noticed it before. He may have, but it's very likely that after Mordecai got ratted out, that Haman made a special walk through the courtyard, if you will, and then all of a sudden, "Oh, look, that guy over there is not bowing down." That's entirely possible. Also possible that he was just angry in general. So he's enraged. Verse 6, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And most of your commentaries regard Haman as an irrational psychopath, which he may have been. But this reaction has nothing to do with him being an irrational psychopath. It has everything to do with him being an Agagite. So he's now has an opportunity, if you will, to redress the wrong that was dealt to his ancestors by the Jews. And so I'm suggesting to you that that's the reason his reaction is so extreme, as opposed to simply nailing this one guy and hanging him or throwing him in prison or something. It's, I have an opportunity here. I think that's what's going on. Verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, they cast lots, before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Now, I have no idea what question they're asking there. Biblically, casting lots is by way of asking yes-no questions of God. Should I go up in battle right now and the priest will cast the lot and he'll get a yes or no answer? I don't know what question Haman is asking, and I don't know what's going on for him to have had lots cast in front of him day by day for a year. Just don't have any idea. Obviously, he is seeking something. He is seeking an auspicious time to do something. So the question may be, is this a good time to go approach the king? And the answer may be no, 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 and then finally yes. I mean, it could be that kind of a question. The best I can come up with here is he's looking for the auspicious time to speak to the king. But that's a guess. Verse 8. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. In other words, they aren't doing anything for you. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So he's saying, these people are not doing you any good, and this is a guess on my part, I will cover the taxes they would have paid. Even if they're not much use, they still pay taxes. And one of the things that could be going on here is Haman is saying, I'll cover the taxes they would have paid for a period of time. Yeah, 10,000 talents of silver is a lot of silver. Now, understand that he is the king's viceroy, which means all of the king's business goes through him. If somebody wants to contract to do something, you got to go through this guy. And if you want it to get before the king, you got to bribe him. And by the way, that kind of practice is standard all over the world to this day. So the fact that he is the gatekeeper to the king is worth a lot of money. And obviously he has a lot of money. By the way, I was reading an article, I think in Wikipedia, when I said that Xerxes commanded the invasion of Greece, lost the naval battle of Salamis, and then Wikipedia said he went home and embarked on a building program, building palaces and building monuments and all that kind of stuff. So you have a lot of contractors. The people who are going to be handling the building have to go through the chief of staff in order to get hired and in order to get jobs. So the fact that he's got 10,000 talents of silver, I don't find at all strange. Understand that in that society and in many societies in the world, he is not being dishonest. Everybody understands that you got to pay the chief of staff, and the king understands it. This is not something that anybody would condemn him for. It's just the way things are done. I am guessing that the 10,000 talents of silver was to compensate the king for lost revenue from the taxes and productivity of these people, or they're going to be wiped out. The king has got everything. I don't think that he is bribing the king per se. I think that it is presented as getting rid of those people is going to cost you. I'll cover it. But it's in your best interest, O king, to get rid of these people because they don't follow your laws. And in fact, during the Roman persecutions of Christians, one of the emperors asked about these Christians. And he was told they are good citizens. They pay their taxes. They don't make any waves. However, they do not honor the gods. And the emperor said, persecute them. When later Roman emperors tried to reinstate paganism, as in, I believe in paganism, we're going to be pagans, the problem with Christians is they didn't honor the pagan gods. Not that they were badly behaved, not that they were a problem. In order for Rome to prosper, we need to make the appropriate obeisance to the pagan gods. We got to do the sacrifices, we got to placate them, we got to pray to them, because the pagan gods are the protectors of Rome. You got all these people that don't. Hence, they are a spiritual liability to Rome, and we need to suppress them. Same kind of thing is going on here with the Jews. Haman is saying, these people don't follow our customs and don't follow our laws, and they don't worship our gods. Really be better if we got rid of them. I am suspecting that that's how the conversation sort of went. Verse 10, so the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as seems good to you. Now, again, the money here, I suspect, is that 10,000 talents of silver that Haman is going to pay into the king's treasury. The king then turns around and says, all right, now use that money to carry out your plan. Verse 12. Then the king's scribe were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict according to all that Haman commanded was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. A number of things going on here. Thing one is the incentive for this, other than the king says get rid of them all, the incentive is, oh, by the way, you get to take their stuff. Jews typically do well wherever they are, so one may assume that their stuff was substantial because they have been in Babylonian and Persian exile for over a century now. So they've settled in. They've started businesses and done all that kind of stuff. So one can assume that they had substantial assets. So the idea that not only do you get to kill them all, but you get to keep their stuff, which is to say you don't have to give the king a share. That is, if you will, incentive. In fact, I read the expulsion of the Jews from Great Britain. They were expelled from Great Britain on Tisha B'Av in the 13th century. So Edward I in 1290 expelled the Jews, and then Cromwell got rid of the monarchy for a while and wanted the Jews to come back. And the opposition from common people was fierce. So the idea that we get to kill them all with government sanction would have been very popular with a certain segment of the population. And with a segment of the population that it might not have been quite so popular with, there was the incentive of, oh, by the way, you get to keep their stuff. So he sort of got both bases covered, if you will. The question was, he gave them 11 months. Why? Two reasons. Reason number one is I suspect he cast lots. And that's when the time came up. Because remember, he's been casting lots all this time. So I am suspecting that's probably part of it. And the other part of it is he needs time for those orders to go throughout the empire. Pony Express, if you will. But Pony Express from Susa to somewhere in India is going to take a little while. So you've got time to disseminate the message, and that's going to take, I don't know how long, but certainly not 24 hours. And then once that happens, you have, you sent the message to the governor of Indian province. Well, then he's got to get things organized himself, and that will take time. So, short answer to your question is I'm not sure, but I can certainly see both practical and occult reasons for a delay. Now, the next question that we have, obviously you're all asking and burning with this question, is what's Mordecai's problem? Because there is nothing in Jewish law that prevents a Jew from bowing in the presence of a monarch. Zero, zip, zilch, nada. So it is not the case that Mordecai is not bowing down before the king's viceroy simply because he is a high government official and boy, I'm a Jew and I don't bow down to anybody. Esther will throw herself on the floor in front of the king. She'll bow down to him. Jacob's sons bow down to Joseph when they think he's a high Egyptian official. As I say, there's nothing anywhere in the Torah or in Jewish law that prevents a Jew from bowing down to a government official, as an expression of courtesy and all that kind of stuff. So the question becomes, what is Haman's problem here? Hazzoni has an answer, and I will give you his answer, and I think it may be right. The reason he doesn't bow down is not because he is disrespecting either Haman or the king, but because things are heading in the direction of a deified king and his priest. You remember in the case of Pharaoh, Pharaoh was regarded as a deity by the Egyptians. And what had been the case before is Ahasuerus had had this whole crowd of people, and they were all singing and dancing and drinking and having a good time for 6 months. But there was no indication that he regarded himself as a deity. What Hazzoni says about this is there is an indication that as Ahasuerus withdraws into his bunker, the palace, if you will, and he gets his viceroy up in front of him, his viceroy has now got, I am the high priest who has access to the God King. And that is entirely consistent with virtually every other pagan government in that region at that time. And by the way, there's a rabbinic commentary that one of the reasons he wouldn't do it is because Haman had an idol on a chain around his neck. So Mordecai wouldn't bow down in front of the idol. And Hazzoni's point is, Jews don't have a problem bowing before kings, they have a problem bowing before idols. The reason that the Jews are in exile is because of idol worship. And one of the things that I've said many times during Midrash is exile is therapeutic, which is to say, Israel falls into some pattern of behavior, and God then sends them to exile, where they get that behavior on steroids, and that wrings it out of them. So the first exile of the Jews was for idolatry. Solomon had brought in pagan worship with all of his wives, and Israel had descended into idolatry, which eventually then led to violence and child sacrifice and all sorts of other stuff. So God says, you guys want to do idols? Fine. We'll send you to Idol Central. We'll send you to Babylon. The same thing happened during the Roman exile. The problem there wasn't idol worship because idol worship had been wrung out of Israel in Babylon. Oh, we're not supposed to worship idols. Okay, we got it. No more idols for us. And they did not worship idols. What they were, however, was too many scorpions in one bottle. The rabbis call it baseless hatred. In other words, we couldn't get along with each other. And of course, the apotheosis of that is when they crucified the Messiah for no particular reason. So the fact was that their society had devolved into backbiting, hatred, and so forth. They couldn't get along and all that kind of stuff. So God says, huh, you guys want hatred? Okay, we'll send you into exile here, and we'll send you into places like Rome and Nazi Germany and England, where you get thrown out, and Poland, where you get killed in pogroms, and Russia, where you get killed in pogroms. You want baseless hatred? We'll do baseless hatred for a while. The point here is, Mordecai, as the product of that, was not going to bow down to anything that could be regarded as an idol. And according to Hazael, I think it makes sense. That's the reason why he isn't bowing down, is either Haman has got an idol around his neck, which is not unusual. Haman may, in fact, have had an effigy of the king around his neck, which would have been, again, an idol. So that's the best rationale I have heard for Mordecai's problem. Because if he simply doesn't like Haman, then what he's doing is being a jerk. And he is putting his entire people at risk over a matter of personal pique. And if it had simply been personal pique and personal power jealousy, then Mordecai's a jerk, because he's put his entire people at risk over a personal problem. If, on the other hand, Hazoni is right, and the problem is he looking on this as idol worship, then he is not a jerk. He is, in fact, being principled. Do with that as seems good. It's all speculation. None of what I have said is in Scripture, but it makes sense to me, or I wouldn't have said it. Oh, and the other thing that's going on, the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. I suspect that there was a very healthy Jewish community in Susa, because it's the capital. And God bless them. One of the things the Jews are is competent, and they ascend to places of influence and power. And when they're good, they're very, very good. And when they're bad, they are horrid. But they do tend to gravitate toward places of influence. And that's just because they're a talented people. And when they use their talents for good, they win Nobel Prizes and they find new medical advances and all sorts of stuff. And when they're bad, they set up the New World Order and all sorts of other stuff. They're people just like everybody else. Some of them are good and some of them are bad. And the fact that they are talented makes the good and the bad really extreme. And of course, most people focus on the bad and hence hate the Jews, but there are more good ones than bad ones, and the bad ones are just very good at being bad. The comment was, what must it have been like as a Jew after that edict was issued to be living under a sentence of death? And one of the things that will happen later in the book, and I'll talk about it more when we get there, when Mordecai gets raised to viceroy himself, what Mordecai does is advertises, A, I'm a Jew, and B, really struts his stuff so that everybody can see that he is highly favored of the king. He is extremely powerful, and oh, by the way, he's also a Jew. What he's doing is he's intimidating the people out there who, well, I know the edict has been repealed, but telling them all is a good idea anyway. And what he's doing is he is intimidating those folks by letting them know that if you go after my people, you're going to regret it. So there's a whole lot of psychological warfare going on here. The edict against the Jews is intended to demoralize them. If you are living under a death sentence constantly and you watch the clock tick down, your morale is going to be pretty low. And the idea there is to make the Jews be dejected and give up, and say there's no use protesting because I'm going to die. Mordecai will do it just the other way when he gets to be viceroy, and he'll say, don't you touch my people. You see how powerful I am? I am also vindictive. So there's a whole lot of that kind of thing going on in this book. The comment was, would they not have the ability to flee to Judea? Judea is still in the Persian Empire. In fact, I've just been reading Nehemiah. And there is significant opposition to rebuilding Jerusalem in that area. So getting that edict carried out in that area wouldn't be a problem. I'm sort of expecting that they look around, there's no place to flee to. And if you did start to flee, I wouldn't be surprised if people would try and stop you. Again, that's all speculation, obviously.